This is Saturday, August 14th, 2004, at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. We are having the very last lecture of the two-week session. My name is Lee Wolfenden, and my topic is the Garden City, New Jerusalem. To look back on our sessions, the first week's theme was geographical correspondences, in which we talked about the various geographical regions of the Bible story and talked about their correspondences, their spiritual meanings. And this week, the second week of camp, we have been using that foundation or map that we laid out the first week as the scene for the journey of regeneration and the travels that we make through those lands whose meanings we learned about last week. So one week has laid the foundation for the other. I think it's kind of interesting this year that the themes one for the 2 weeks built one upon the other for really a seamless whole. And what we did was we drew the map on which the story of the journey of regeneration or rebirth takes place. In doing that, we've been largely focusing on the journey from the early days in Shinar in Babylonia, where the Garden of Eden was supposed to have been, and through the Fertile Crescent and into Canaan, and then also the journey from Egypt, where the Israelites were enslaved, into Canaan. So we've generally taken the journey as being from either Babylonia to Canaan or from Egypt to Canaan. However, that's a rather Old Testament view of things. We really haven't done very much with the New Testament these 2 weeks. And in fact, if you look at the entire Christian Bible, the journey is not a journey from Babylonia to Canaan, nor is it a journey from Egypt to Canaan. Now, before I go further, I want to say it's perfectly valid to take the journey from Egypt to Canaan as a spiritual unit, as telling our entire spiritual story. As George Dole is very fond of pointing out, the Bible operates on a holographic model where any subset can be taken as telling the whole story. And this is derived from Swedenborg as well, who uses the first chapter and few verses to tell the entire story. The first chapter and few verses being the creation story, which Swedenborg says tells the entire story of our spiritual rebirth process. And in his Arcana Celestia, he takes several units just from the books of Genesis and Exodus. So it's perfectly valid to use the journey from Egypt to Canaan or from Babylonia to Canaan as the story of our entire spiritual rebirth journey. But that is not the entire story as it's given in the Christian Bible, encompassing both Old and New Testaments. In fact, the destination of the entire Bible story from a Christian perspective is not Canaan. You may think it is because Jerusalem is in Canaan, but the destination is the New Jerusalem. And the New Jerusalem, as I'm going to show in a minute, is not in Canaan. In fact, the New Jerusalem is the entire ancient world. The entire world of the Bible is the destination for the entire Bible story geographically. And to illustrate that, I'm going to flip the map around. I had a little trouble drawing this on there because Becky, when she drew this map, had to compress it a little bit horizontally. And I really wanted it to be a square because it says in the description of the New Jerusalem that the city lies four square. Well, we've been accustomed, I think, sometimes to saying that this city, 12,000 stadia, is about 1,500 miles. And we'll say, here we are in North America, so we say that stretches about halfway across the country, and that gives you the idea how big it is. But the ancient Jewish people who were writing these knew nothing about the New World. They were thinking of their world. And if you translate 12,000 stadia into our normal units and then impose it upon the map, it actually does encompass the entire land in which the whole Bible scene took place. If you start here just a little bit over from Babylonia, from Shinar, and you continue over, it goes right past Asia Minor. If you go from the north of Asia Minor, of present-day Turkey, and you go down, it actually continues on farther into Ethiopia. And the entire Bible story, all of the events that take place in the Bible, including the New Testament, excluding the Pauline epistles and the Roman part, but including all that Swedenborg says is the Word of God, it all takes place within the quadrangle that the New Jerusalem would cover if it were literally to descend from heaven to earth. So the destination of the entire Bible story is not Canaan. The destination is the entire world. And I think the meaning of that will, I hope the meaning of that will become clearer and clearer as we go on today. To make it fairly clear right from the start, the destination is not just the heart. It's not just the inner spiritual self. The destination is our entire life. And at the end of the spiritual journey, our entire life, inner and outer, thoughts and feelings, head and heart, ideas and carry through actions, all of it is encompassed in our spiritual life. And I don't know if I am justified in making all of these assignments, but I'm going to do it anyway. I like M. Scott Peck's account of how he came to be a Christian. And this was after he wrote his famous book, The Road Less Traveled. He says in a later book, Further Along the Road Less Traveled, he says, when I wrote that book, I quoted from Jesus. And he says, I'm a guy who does his writing and then does his research afterwards. And he said, I figured, well, if I quoted from Jesus, I probably better find out what he was really about. And so he actually read the New Testament after having written the book and quoted from him, and he was just simply amazed by what he found there. And it ended out sending him on a pathway toward becoming a Christian because of the incredible character of Jesus that he found, completely unlike what he expected from his early Sunday school upbringing. So I'm going to just lay things out there, and later on I might actually do the research and see if this makes sense. Swedenborg talks about four major loves that everything is encompassed by and that are supposed to be in proper order in us. And I do this all the time with the teens and the kids and the adults, so you hang around me for very long, you're going to know what those four major loves are. They are love of the Lord, love of the neighbor, and these, of course, are encompassed in Jesus' giving of the great commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the top dogs when it comes to the loves. And then there's also love of world and love of self. Love of world being essentially materialism and materialistic focus, if it's dominant, and love of self having to do with love of dominating others because you think you're better than them in a negative sense. But in a positive sense, love of the world is being able to function well in the world and use the world's resources and capabilities to accomplish higher goals. And love of self is keeping yourself in good shape, having that self-esteem, but in a healthy way so that you're able to serve the neighbor. So what I'm going to do is venture out and make some assignments here of the different major regions of the ancient world to those four loves, because it seems like there ought to be, if those are the four dominant love, the four that encompass all of our spiritual and material life, they ought to be reflected in the geography. And there are a couple of them that I think are fairly easy to make, because I know Swedenborg does it, and that is Babylonia or Shinar is the love of self that we start from. Early on, we're wrapped up in our own selves primarily. So I'm going to assign what's marked here as Shinar, but is usually called Babylonia, as love of self. Another one that I think works fairly well is Egypt, which is spiritually the land of outer knowledge, of learning about the world, including learning about the material side, the biblical record of religion. That is Egypt. It's outward knowledge. And I think a case can be made that this is love of the world, that the sin of Egypt is having a worldly focus rather than a spiritual one, whereas the sin of Babylon is believing that I should dominate everything, including religion. So I'm assigning love of self to Babylonia and love of the world to Egypt. This leaves Assyria and Canaan as the two major remaining regions in the ancient world. I think it would be fairly clear that Canaan would be love of the Lord. That's what true spirituality is all about, and Canaan is the land of spiritual focus. So Canaan then would be love of the Lord, and we have love of the neighbor, love of the neighbor left. And so I'm maybe stretching things a little bit and saying that Assyria, which Swedenborg assigns as the rational, would then be love of the neighbor. And one thought I had on this is the Unitarian Church. I recently preached a sermon in which I said that when you build a religion based on human thought and reason and rationality, in a good sense, what comes out the other end is the Unitarian Church, which has essentially thrown its theology aside. It no longer is Christian in focus, except for some of the old Unitarians who still keep the Christian tradition alive. But as far as the theology of the church, there's no particular theology of God, there's no particular theology of the spiritual world or of the afterlife or any of these things, and yet it is a church that is focused on serving the neighbor. It's a humanitarian church, and it's based on many human figures who had very rational views and spiritually derived, but primarily rational views of the world, and who from that enlightened reason believed that we should serve the world in many different ways. And so I'm thinking that that might be a working assignment for Assyria. So to run back over that again, of the four loves, and I'll do them in order now from top to bottom, Canaan would be love of the Lord, Assyria would be love of the neighbor, Egypt would be love of the world, and Babylonia would be the love of self. And the interesting thing about the New Jerusalem is that it encompasses all of these. It takes in Babylonia and Assyria and Egypt and Canaan. It covers that whole footprint. And it also, incidentally, covers the footprint where the seven churches in Asia were. It would take in the entirety of Asia Minor as well. So all of those are encompassed within the New Jerusalem. And I think this is completely in line with Swedenborg's teachings that when everything is in order, well, why don't I read you a little brief quote that I put into the July 2003 issue of Our Daily Bread on the country and the kingdom. And by the way, this is a great issue for this week's theme, so pick up a copy. It's only 25 cents, all going to the assembly. Swedenborg writes in Arcana Celestia number 4099.2, "The worldly and heavenly elements in us harmonize with each other when the heavenly ones rule the worldly, but not when the worldly ones rule the heavenly." And this is a brief way of saying that when those two top loves, of the Lord and the neighbor, the heavenly loves, are in control, are ruling our lives, governing our lives, then the worldly ones, love of the world and self, are also in harmony. Whereas when the worldly ones rule, then the heavenly ones get out of joint and they become servants when they should be masters and that sort of thing. And we are, in Swedenborg's colorful language, an upside-down human being. Our heads where our feet should be and our feet where our head should be. But when the heavenly ones are ruling, all of those loves are in their proper order and they are all part of our spiritual life. So that not only our love of God and the neighbor is part of our spiritual life, but also our love for the world and love for self. They all form a part of our spiritual life. And very importantly, not only our thinking and our beliefs are in harmony, but our heart is there with motives of love, and our hands are there with a life of active service to our fellow human beings, which is also a life of service to God. So the destination of our journey is not just Canaan. It is not just being off on the desert island or at the mountaintop contemplating the nature of God and being spiritual. It encompasses the full life of, yes, approaching the Lord at the center, but also thinking and reasoning about this world and trying to understand it and about spiritual things. Of being driven by various motives into actually living out our religion, using our life, including our job and our career, including the way we make our money. to be in service to God and in service to our fellow human beings. So it's a very holistic and full destination that's not limited to just spiritual contemplation. And just to give a little bit of biblical background, I'm going to once again read to you a little bit from the prophet Isaiah. Some of you, I know, have heard this already during this session. This is from Isaiah chapter 19, verses 23 to 25, and it gets in three of the four regions, and I think we can sort of bring in the fourth in our minds as well. This is the prophet Isaiah speaking. On that day, in other words, the day of the Lord, the day when the Lord is truly reigning the earth, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. On that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, "Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my heritage." So here's a vision of at least three of the four major biblical regions all working together and all seeing the Lord as their God. And this is only fulfilled in the New Jerusalem, encompassing the entire ancient world. Now, there's another way to see the journey of regeneration, which Susanna referred to in her lecture just now, and that is the journey that we take from what Swedenborg calls the innocence of ignorance to, at the other end, the innocence of wisdom. And that's the one that I'd like to spend a little time looking at now, because I believe this is the journey from the Garden of Eden. After the initial creation, humankind was placed in the Garden of Eden. And in the end of the journey, there is the holy city, New Jerusalem. There's a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song, I believe, that says, "We've got to get ourselves back to the garden," and it's a great song, you know, I love it. But, wait a minute, that's not quite right, because we never do get back to the garden. There's many people who, their ideal is to have humankind go back to its early, simple, pastoral roots, and that's what we should all be striving for. Get rid of all the technology, get rid of all the complications, and get us back onto the land and being natural, and that's what our eventual destination should be. It should look a lot like where we came from. And certainly there will be people getting back to the land, I certainly hope so. And that's encompassed in the New Jerusalem just as everything else is. And yet, the New Jerusalem is presented as a city, as the ultimate in human ingenuity. You look at a city, it's the most complicated thing that we do as humans. Building cities and getting them to work together, it's a very complex setup. And that is what is given as the destination of the Bible story, not going back to the Garden of Eden. So there is a progression from a very simple state to a very complex state. And that would be reflected in a more abstract way in Swedenborg's statement that we move from the innocence of ignorance to the innocence of wisdom. Now, the innocence of ignorance is not, innocence means not harming. That's a very literal translation of the root of the word innocent. Not harming anyone else, or anything for that matter. And the innocence of ignorance is when we do no harm because we don't know any better. An infant is entirely innocent. It's also entirely incapable of visiting harm upon another human being. Well, there's a little bit of capability there, but really, I mean, once they get teeth, yeah, then it all changes. But if you think about a battle between a baby and a full-grown human being, there is no contest there, because the baby simply does not have the capability, the strength, and the intelligence, and the size to be able to do any harm. That is the innocence of ignorance. It's the innocence of not harming because we don't know any better. All we know is how things naturally work, and we do that. And that is the innocence of the Garden of Eden. God put Adam and Eve, the early human beings, into the garden to tend it and to keep it. And the garden generally grew itself. They were fully in harmony with their natural environment. And if we look back at early human beings, no matter what theory of human origins you want to posit, back at the beginning, there is a stage of human beings being fully in tune with the environment and being really a working part of the environment and not being able to do anything else because that's all that humans knew. And if you look at our various discoveries of what we are wont to call primitive societies in various out-of-the-way parts of the world back in the jungle, we find that there are these people who are still living in great harmony with nature. And we also find that they are very quickly co-opted and overrun by modern civilization because they've been living in that state from an innocence of ignorance, where they live that way because, quite frankly, they don't have the technological capabilities to do anything else. And their entire lives is simply focused on being able to survive through their various seasons and have enough for themselves. And as soon as they encounter modern technology, as it gets in there, they say, wow, this is great, you know, we don't have to work so hard, or whatever they think. You know, look at that, you can see a picture of yourself. They're amazed and sometimes repelled, but slowly but surely and sometimes very rapidly, that ancient civilization is taken over by modern technology. And we, from our perspective, see it as they have been spoiled. They had this pristine life, and now it's been spoiled by the encroachment of modern technology. Well, the very same thing happened with the Garden of Eden. Pretty soon, Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They were kicked out of the garden. Instead of things just growing luxuriantly and they sort of trimmed them here and there, now they had to work with the sweat of their brow and raise grain in the fields and grind it and make bread and all of the hard work that we still know as what it takes to survive in this world. And so the Bible story shows that loss of innocence, the innocence of ignorance, of not knowing anything different. And we see that as a loss, and yet it is part of the path toward a greater innocence. The innocence of wisdom is a stronger innocence than the innocence of ignorance, because the innocence of wisdom is when we've been through life's mill, when we've grown up, when we've seen how hard it is and what difficult decisions there are and how the evil tries to drag us down and sometimes does, and we have to struggle against it and fight against it and make tough decisions and push ourselves to do the right thing when we don't want to. And when we get to the whole other end of that, then we get to a stage where we're once again harmless, where we would never harm anyone else if we can possibly help it, but not because we don't know any better. Now we wouldn't harm anyone because we've seen both good and evil. We've eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And that word knowledge is not just intellectual knowing. The Hebrew word has the sense of the experience, and you could translate that as the tree of the experience of good and evil. By the time we've reached the innocence of wisdom, we have experienced both good and evil. We've seen what each of them leads to. We've felt it in our own hearts and minds and lives and experienced it. And we have chosen, with the Lord's help, the good. And so the innocence of wisdom is moving to a state where we're once again living in harmony with God, with our neighbor, and with the natural world, and yet from a position of strength and knowledge and wisdom, of having seen the alternatives and consciously chosen this good and harmonious life. And that is the far more complex world of the heavenly city, New Jerusalem, where you have human constructions. And yet, even as I thought about that preparing this lecture, they're not human constructions. Where did the city come from? It came from heaven, out of heaven, from God. This was a city created by God for the humans to inhabit. And so even the cityscape there is a creation of God. God is creating us into a highly organized, complex human organism of people who have consciously chosen to live the life of love and to live the life of wisdom. God has chosen and created that for us and created it in us. It's all God's work. So we travel from the innocence of ignorance, which is the Garden of Eden, to the innocence of wisdom, which is the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven. And yet we find that in the New Jerusalem, the primary elements of the Garden of Eden are also present. And I was going to read you the entire story. I think I won't do that. You can read it on your own. But I do want to read you the particular section that relates to this talk, and that is about the garden aspects of this New Jerusalem. This is the first few verses of Revelation chapter 22, and the holy city has already been largely described. And the final part of the description is here, is this. Then the angel showed me, that being John, showed me the river of the water of life, bright as a crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. And at this point, most of the newer translations sort of gloss over what the Greek actually says, and I'm going to read from the note here of a somewhat more literal translation of it. It says, in the middle of the street of the city and on either side of the river is the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Nothing accursed will be found there anymore, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and there will be no more night. They need no light of the lamp or of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. And this is these are the final words of the description of that new Jerusalem. And where have we seen the tree of life before? In the Garden of Eden. It was at the very beginning. It says God created all of the, why don't I just read it to you? It'd probably be better in the Bible's words than trying to put it in my words. This is, again, from toward the end of the initial description of the garden that God planted in Eden. It says, out of the ground the Lord God made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst or the middle of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then I believe it entirely disappears after that until we get to Revelation. I didn't have a chance to actually look it up in the concordance, but I believe that it appears in the early chapters there in the Garden of Eden and then is absent from the story until we get to the book of Revelation. And here it is again, that central garden nature of the Garden of Eden contained within the holy city, New Jerusalem. And here I have to talk about a little pet peeve of mine about the artistic rendition of the holy city, New Jerusalem, because I've seen these portraits of it, these beautiful portraits with this big old cube coming down from heaven. And the Bible doesn't say it's a cube. Book of Revelation says that it lies four square. So we do know that it's square, but it says nothing about a cube. And then it talks about the walls being 144 cubits. And unfortunately, probably due to the spiritual sense, it doesn't say whether the wall is 144 cubits high or 144 cubits thick. Either one of those would be a valid interpretation. And this would be a little over 200 feet that it would be, either high or thick. Well, rushing in once again where angels fear to tread, I think it's talking about how high the wall is. I don't think the wall is 12,000 stadia high, which is the way that it's being portrayed in many depictions of the heavenly city. It's not a big old cube. Now, a cube would be something like the science fiction writers would make, where you have an entirely enclosed city with everything inside of this big old structure that can be out in space and be self-contained. I don't think that's the way that the New Jerusalem looks. Rather, if you've seen pictures of Mount Saint Michel off the coast of France, and you see this very small but cityscape being built up upon a mountain with buildings reaching right up to the pinnacle at the top, I think that this is more what the New Jerusalem visually would look like, with a wall 144 cubits high, and then it rose up almost like a pyramid to the very top of it, and you have essentially a city built on a mountain, a huge mountain, which literally would go out well beyond the stratosphere and it would be unbreathable. But for our purposes, it's like a mountain city reaching from the lowlands all the way up to the very tip, which is as high as the city is wide. It'd be a fairly steep city if you really drew it that way. And yet it talks about those trees growing in there. And I like to think of some of the walled cities. For example, there was an article in the National Geographic on the city of Berlin, which was then West Berlin, and it was completely surrounded by East Germany, and it had a wall around it, and it was the city of West Berlin. And yet there were photos in that article of farmers farming within the walls of that city. because contained within that city was not only the urban center, but also, right in miniature, the rural parts of that city. And so if we can picture the New Jerusalem as similar to that, with the urban centers, but also the more rural parts, remember, this is a huge place, there's going to be variety within it, that we have, in fact, the city encompassing the garden. We have the city, we have the suburbs, we have the rural farming, gardening parts, and all of that is encompassed within the city. So if you are the sort that likes to go back to the land, you can do it in the New Jerusalem. And if you're the sort that likes to live in the exciting city center, you can do that in the New Jerusalem. And if you like something in between, that is also encompassed in the New Jerusalem. The general point being that all of human experience and all of the varieties of how humans like to live out their lives and what gifts God has given us are encompassed in that holy city. Well, I could probably say more here, but I think I've probably said enough. I hope I've said enough to get a few thoughts flowing. So why don't I open up the floor and see if we have some continuation in the form of discussion. Susanna.
I want to thank you for using the map. I'm a visual person and it helps to have a drawing. But I was struck when you were identifying the loves with the different areas. The love of the self to the love of the Lord is the east-west motion. And if you think of the way the sun, I mean, that's a daily walk that we do. Is it going to be all about me or all about the Lord? And every morning we wake up with that question again. Is it all about me or is it all about the Lord? And we have to go through that. But yet you've got the love of the neighbor and the love of the world, the two sort of communal aspects. And depending on what hemisphere you're in, it's like seasons. You go through seasons of being in love of the neighbor or a season of love of the world. Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of maybe larger cycles within us, but we have a daily walk in deciding individually, are we following ourselves or the Lord?
Thank you.
Thanks for the map.
Well, thank you for the further insight. Yes, George.
On the innocence of ignorance and innocence of wisdom, I think one critical part of this is that an infant initially has absolutely no sense of self as being apart from its environment.
Yes.
And it is one with everything, so to speak, consciously. And in that sense, it can't do harm to anything else because there isn't anything else.
There isn't anything else.
Period.
Yeah.
And the innocence of wisdom is having realized one's individuality and then realizing how embedded that is. And that it isn't an individuality over against and opposed to and in competition with the rest of reality. It really is an integral part of it.
Yes. And that calls to mind two thoughts, taking the second first, that Swedenborg describes the individuality of angels, and he says the higher up in heaven you go, the more the angels recognize or sense themselves as unique individuals, and yet the more they realize that they belong to the Lord. The two are together. The individuality and the belonging to the Lord are together. The other is an insight that I got from my brother Ross some years back, which I always appreciated, and that is talking about those ancient people, the Garden of Eden types. What would they have looked like to an archaeologist or a paleontologist or somebody who studies the early origins of humankind? And what they would probably have looked like is almost animals who were living very much in harmony with and embedded in the natural world. And from outside, you may not even have known that there was any level of thinking or God worshiping at all, because they were simply embedded in that natural world and their spiritual experience was coming from within and apparently was not yet hooked up with external constructed religious realities like altars and that sort of thing. They simply looked around and saw God everywhere, but they didn't build altars to do that. Their whole world was their altar. The whole world was the place where God's presence was. And so they were completely embedded within the natural world while looking at it from a spiritual perspective. David.
I seem to hear you talking as if it was a natural city, and even in the literal sense, John is seeing a vision, and in the spiritual sense, isn't it a spiritual city, not a natural?
Yes, and this is something I've, speaking of debating fundamentalists, that I've lately added to my quiver of arrows, shall we say, that when John gives the vision in the book of Revelation, there are several points, at least four, and I think more, where he says, I was in the Spirit, and I saw. And he makes it very clear that this entire vision is seen not in the material world, but in the spiritual world. And it's a rather strange leap to then say that this is all going to take place literally in the physical world, because that's not how John described it. Even in the literal sense of the book of Revelation, it's described as something that takes place in the spiritual world. And certainly we think of this as a spiritual city, not a literal one. Literally, it simply wouldn't work if it was that high. It would have to be the science fiction enclosed thing, because it would be out in space. There would be no breathable air there. It would be unlivable.
And with the Lord, all things are possible.
Yeah, with the Lord, all things are possible. That answers all objections. Yes, Ken.
I just wanted to comment that your description of the earth, of how archaeologists would see the early Garden of Eden folks, is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds so much like a description of the Native Americans and their spirituality, which was not externalized in altars and churches, and even their life remained fairly primitive because they weren't pursuing external things to make their life easy, and their spirituality was very much seeing the divine presence manifest in the world. I personally believe it was what they were talking about is not a kind of pantheism, but they were seeing correspondence. That they saw the different aspects of the earth reflecting the divine presence and the divine character. And yet, to the Western mind, they were just ignorant savages with no spirituality and just wasting the land and taking up space.
Yeah, and there are interesting hints both in the biblical story and in Swedenborg that there actually were some survivors other than Noah and his family from the flood. That in fact there were some of the earlier peoples that somehow managed to ride out the flood. And a scholarly way of looking at that is that this, you know, being centered in Mesopotamia where there were rivers, not Mesopotamia, but in Babylonia where there were rivers and could be floods, that this was really a localized flood that they had experienced and that gave the basis for the literal story. And yet there were people outside of the floodplain that survived. And there are hints in Swedenborg that there are various religions that have survived from those ancient times, although he generally tends to state that they've become corrupted in one way or another. And as much as I like Native American theology, I would not want to be on the stake when they were burning one of their enemies and seeing how whether he screams out while it's happening, because that's a rather corrupted form of being in harmony with nature. And yet I do think that Native American spirituality is probably descended in some way, perhaps from the most ancient church, where I tend to think of Hinduism as coming from the ancient church. And these have actually survived outside of the orbit of the Judeo-Christian world into the present day in some form or fashion. George?
In the 18th century, and with the discovery of the New World and that there were people in it who, as far as anybody could see, could not conceivably have been descended from Noah because there was no connection. There were theories about pre-Adamites,
mm-hmm.
and there are little reflections of that in Swedenborg from time to time. And this also sparked by the fact that Cain was afraid somebody else was going to kill him.
Yes. So
there must have been some other people
right.
besides the descendants of Adam and Eve. And
right.
pre-Adamites, and
yes.
that's where the Native Americans came from.
Yes, and I believe also that I may be wrong on this, but I think some of the giants that were supposed to be in the land may have had links to peoples that shouldn't have survived through the flood. So there's little hints here and there, and Swedenborg occasionally talks about the pre-Adamites, and we do get these glimpses of what those very ancient people may have been like, although I don't think we're seeing them exactly as they were. We're seeing something pretty close. And I believe that the Native American, what we call the earth-based religions in general, are probably as good a picture as we're going to get of how those very ancient people lived and what their religion was like. Yes, Dean.
So the tree of life in the Garden of Eden was on the edge, and then New Jerusalem is in the middle?
Well, it says that the tree of life was in the middle of the street and on either side of the river. I haven't done enough reading of this to completely get it straight in my mind. And when Swedenborg interprets this, by the way, he even says this wouldn't really work in literal reality, but it's said that way because of the spiritual sense. Because in one way of reading it, the tree of life is in the middle of the river and on either side. And I recently published a sermon by the Reverend Sarah Buteau in which she said that's an amazing tree that can be both in the middle and on either side of the river at the same time. I always thought of it as being a whole bunch of the trees, you know, lining the river, but it could also be conceived of as a single tree. And it is talked about as being in the midst of something, not in the midst of the city, but in the midst of the street or in the midst of the river, depending on which way. So there is a centrality as well to the garden image in the New Jerusalem. Ken?
Yeah, I would read that as it's referred to in the singular, but it's referring to lots of trees of life planted in spread out in different places.
A collective, like the fir tree. You're not talking about a particular fir tree, you're talking about fir trees in general.
Right. Well, also, I find it interesting that at the beginning of life, the tree of life is the one tree that God makes sure people don't have access to, that they would live forever and be like us. And yet, in the book of Revelation, which is about the transition into spiritual life, that tree of life is fully accessible.
Yes.
And all its benefits are there for the people.
Yes. David.
It being a physical impossibility, the way it's literally translated, just made me think of a Zen Buddhist cone, where you're supposed to think of something that's physically impossible and it just blanks out your conscious mind and you're more receptive to spiritual truth. And I don't know if that's it, but it could help you imagine it spiritually rather than physically.
I think there's a number of passages in the Bible that are pushing us toward thinking of things spiritually. And the one that I like to point to is, I'm not sure if I can find it quite quickly enough, but in the Gospel of John, there's a place where Jesus he's almost rubbing the noses of his listeners in this thing that he's teaching, which is, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. And he keeps saying it's like he's pounding this nail and eat the flesh, drink the blood. If you think about it literally, you're talking about cannibalism, which most societies on the face of the earth, and certainly ours and theirs, considered absolutely grotesque and completely sacrilegious to eat human flesh. And yet he kept on pounding that in. And many people, it says, left him at that time. This is a hard saying. Who can accept it? And yet he then says, the words I speak to you, they are spirit and they are life. The flesh counts for nothing. It is the spirit that gives life. And so he was pushing them. If you try to think of this literally, you're going to come up with really gross images and it's going to gross you out and you're going to leave. But if you can raise your mind up to the spiritual level, then it all makes sense. And the flesh and the blood, from our perspective, of course, is God's love and God's wisdom, which we are supposed to eat. In other words, bring inside of ourselves. So the Bible in many places pushes us not to take it literally, but to take it spiritually. Ken.
Isn't it the Catholic way, though, to believe that in communion it is, in fact, transmutated?
Yes. Transubstantiation. Right. And the same with, I think of that as another one of those translations where you try to gloss over what the text actually says and we try to make sense of it without lifting our mind up to the higher level. And people have been ingenious at doing that. And yet if you really encounter the text with a willingness to see it from a higher light, you don't need to do the hocus pocus of transubstantiation because you recognize that the whole thing is talking about our inner spiritual life and not a literal occurrence, just as the New Jerusalem, it was seen in heaven, in the spiritual world. It was never intended to be taken literally, and yet we have many taking it literally and saying that all these cataclysms that described are going to take place on this earth. Well, John didn't say they were taking place on this earth. He said they were taking place in heaven, which is the Bible's way of saying on the spiritual level.
And just as a footnote to that, that to me is and not only to me, is one of the real perils of that kind of literalism is that it only in the spiritual world do we get the absolute distinction between heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, Revelation is full of it. There's no question who the good guys and the bad guys are.
Yes.
As soon as you try to literalize that, our enemies are the bad guys and we're the good guys, and you bring that kind of absolutism down into a world where it is disastrous. It's false and distorted.
Yes.
It demonizes everybody who opposes us.
And it's all throughout the Old Testament up to the prophets, and even in the prophets to a certain extent, that attitude was present.
Yeah.
David.
Well, to tie in your lecture, when we're in the holy city and have innocence and wisdom, we'll naturally see it spiritually and not even think about the material.
I like that. We'll naturally think of it spiritually.
Well.
And I think that's probably a good place to stop. We're right about at the end of our lecture.